Welcome to Women on Air, a weekly show about women, feminism, and social justice, brought to you by CFUV's Women's Radio Collective.
You're listening to Women on Air, CFUV Radio 101.9 FM in Victoria. My name's Janine Bancroft. In my analysis, in my philosophical quest to get to the root causes of violence in our world, I chatted a couple of weeks ago on my radio program with a couple from New Jersey, Gary Francione and Anna Charlton. And these are professors at Rutgers University in New Jersey, and they have made it the first university in the United States with an animal rights curriculum. And we had a very interesting chat about, you know, animal rights as it pertains to feminism and animal rights as it pertains to peace in the world and morality. These two have authored a number of books, most recently Eat Like You Care, an examination of the morality of eating animals. So I'm going to rebroadcast this today for you in this different time slot, and I hope you'll stay tuned. Again, you're listening to Women on Air at CFUV Radio 101.9 FM.
I've been publishing the Victoria Street News for 10 years, and it's an examination of the root causes of poverty. I mean, you know, we can build homeless shelters and we can build food banks, but I believe, and some others of my friends and colleagues believe, that we need to get to the root causes of this, and just, you know, so that we don't have poverty to begin with. And I think it's the same thing with peace, that we need to get to the root causes of violence in our society. And my friends in the peace movement would say, you know, that peace begins at home, that we need to mend our familial and friend relationships before we can hope to have peace in the world. Would you agree with that?
Well, Anna, why don't you start with that?
Well, absolutely, and that's getting to the core of the problem is something that we've always tried to focus on, because there are so many unfocused campaigns and petitions and areas of interest for people who are concerned about animals, and it jumps from one distressing story to another without a really unified and thoughtful approach of addressing the core problem of the use of animals, not any particular circumstance in an animal industry, but whether we are justified in using animals. So I sympathize very much with your desire to get to the core of a problem, because otherwise you're always reacting and putting band-aids on and diluting your efficacy instead of focusing on the real core problem.
I would like to add 2 points. I think that you know, you mentioned, Janine, the peace movement, and I think there are two further comments to make. One is that I find it always very disconcerting when people talk to me about nonviolence and they're not vegans. I mean, I don't understand that, because there's absolutely no need for us to eat animal products. It's gratuitous violence. It's engaging in gratuitous violence. And so, you know, as I often say, you know, when words of peace come out of your mouth but things of violence go into your mouth, there's a dissymmetry there, dissonance there that is not good. And the other thing I would say is, even if you don't care morally about animals at all, given the resources, the amount of resources that go into producing meat and dairy and eggs and everything, we could, you know, David Pimentel, at formerly of Cornell University, a very, very respected scientist, tells us and shows that we could be feeding about 800 million people with the plant foods that we feed to animals in the United States alone. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, the idea that we're consuming meat where there's like between 6 and 14 pounds of plant protein for every pound of flesh, or, you know, or 1,000 times more water per pound than there is for wheat or potatoes or something. I mean, the inefficient use of resources and the fact that the consumption of animal products is just involves such an intensive amount of plant protein. It's wrong morally, even if you take animals out of the moral equation. It's wrong with respect to our obligations to humans. I mean, I always find it interesting when people say to me, isn't veganism elitist? And I say, no, absolutely not. Eating fruits, vegetables, nuts, grains, beans, and things like that, that's not elitist at all. What's elitist is thinking that your palate pleasure justifies imposing suffering and death on another sentient being, and the idea that it's quite all right for us to have this elite diet of animal foods at the expense of people who are starving.
Mm-hmm. Anna, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, to echo the human component of this, I mean, you mentioned that we teach a course on human rights and animal rights, and we tease out the fact that these issues are so intertwined, both in the structural approach that we bring to the problem and the practical problems that the continued consumption of animals presents. So our diet raises many, many moral issues for the welfare of and rights of animals, but also the welfare and rights of humans.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And do you think then that this sort of subconscious, unconscious routine that we go through every day, you know, what's the link between that and accepting, you know, that now there is no torture, there's just enhanced interrogation, and you know, the idea that this most recent botched execution in Oklahoma, you know, the idea that capital punishment is really a solution to anything, like, you know, is there a philosophical foundation that connects our daily habits with this more global system of violence that we see?
Well, I think there's a psychological component to it in that we like to tell ourselves these stories that many of these things can be done nicely. I think we all have a level of discomfort, or at least I find it when I talk to people about the issue of eating animals. People are a little bit uncomfortable. You hear so often, don't tell me about that, you'll put me off my dinner. And indeed, if you have that conversation, the person will be put off their dinner. We're not terribly comfortable with it. If we went out and if we were required to go and kill our own food, kill animals for our own dinner tonight, many of us would be choosing something else to eat. Perhaps we would be habituated to it if we did ourselves for a long time. But it's not something that many of us are comfortable with. So we call it different things. We ask someone to do it nicely for us. We're reassured by the people who produce and provide the food to us that it's done nicely. So our moral concern and our emotional and really aesthetic revulsion is tamped down. I think that we call it by another name so it's acceptable. So in the political arena, as you point out, we've now got used to the phrase enhanced interrogation technique. It's displaced torture because all the bells and whistles go on when the word torture comes out, but we're all reassured by this enhanced interrogation technique. Doesn't it sound controlled? Doesn't it sound scientific? Doesn't it sound thoughtful? And the same with the welfare standards that we're all assured can go into the production of the meat that come and dairy products that come to our plates. If we strip that off and see what the actual process are, we're left with the more raw reaction to the reality of these processes.
I mean, look, I think it's clear that however, quote, humane, end quote, and I really don't like that word used in this or most other circumstances or contexts, but however humanely the animal products that you consume today or tonight or whenever are, they involve torture. They involve treatment which, if we were talking about human beings, we would describe as torture. And so what we do is we fantasize, we delude ourselves into believing that we can do these really terrible things and we can do them in a morally acceptable way. And that's one of the reasons why both Anna and I are very critical of the animal, what is called the animal rights movement, which really has nothing to do with animal rights, but the animal welfare movement, which calls itself the animal rights movement. And we're very critical because they promote welfare reform as if this is somehow normatively, you know, that this makes the consumption of animals more compassionate. It means that we can do this more compassionately. I think that that's a really, really dangerous idea. And, you know, what it ends up doing is it ends up making people feel better about continuing to consume animal products and deludes them into believing there's a right way to do this. Just like when we talk about, you know, whether we can humanely kill somebody in capital punishment. I mean, you know, that raises some slightly different issues, because we have at least some people believe that if you engage in certain actions, you forfeit your right to life. Now, Anna and I are both opposed to capital punishment, and so we believe that no matter what you do, you don't forfeit your right to life. You forfeit your right to freedom, but you don't forfeit your life to right to life, rather. And so, you know, but we have, you know, that context is a little bit different, because but with animals, they're completely innocent. I mean, the idea is, I mean, they have done. There's no argument that they've done something culpable which justifies what we do to them. I mean, it really is. It's bizarre. And you know, Janine, going back, sort of bridging the points we're talking about now, I really believe that if we started taking animals seriously and moved toward towards veganism, that in and of itself would not only shift the paradigm for how we treat non-human animals, but it would shift the paradigm for how we treat each other. Because if I take the interests of animals seriously, and I'm not willing to inflict suffering and death on them, even though there's no downside to my doing it. Indeed, there may be a downside to my not doing it, because people don't like the fact that I'm a vegan, or they feel uncomfortable around me, or they feel that my, you know, that my conduct is reprehending them in some way. But if I take it seriously, and then it's going to be much harder for me to act or think violently towards you. And that's what, you know, we've both been vegans for, I guess, how long, Anna? 32 years now? 30?
Something like that. Yeah,
like it was 82, I guess, right? It was 82 that we became vegans. And one of the things that, you know, we both noticed as time went on is that, you know, it was really difficult to feel ill will towards other humans. It just is. I mean, it can't help, I think, in a lot of ways, influencing your views about morality generally, about your treatment of the other, whether that other is human or non-human.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you have vegan dogs as well, I understand.
Yes.
We do, and I have five of them around me as I'm speaking right now, and I'm just hoping that no one breaks into barking while we're on the air. But no, I have five very happy, rescued, somewhat elderly vegan dogs now, who have all thrived on a vegan diet.
Yeah, and we've adopted some animals over the years that have had some significant health problems, and we've been amazed by how well they do on a vegan diet. Our oldest dog right now is at least 19, and she's still, I mean, you know, she's, her eyesight's fading, and you know, she's not, her hearing isn't as good as it used to be, but for a 19-year-old dog, you know, she was, you know, this morning, you know, I let her out at like 5:30 in the morning, and she came back, and she ran up the ramp into the house.
Wow.
And, you know, and she's like 19 years old.
Wow.
And we've had some really problematic health cases over the years, and they've thrived on a vegan diet. I mean, dogs are like us, they're omnivores. They can digest plant protein, they can digest animal protein, and they can get nutrition from either source. And so, you know, it's not a problem.
Well, and I think some of the you know, the least nutritious animal products are going into the animal food too. So that's probably, yeah, they're much better off in many ways. All right. Well,
if you get familiar with what is indeed being produced from slaughterhouses, you can only imagine what the cast off from slaughterhouses that isn't deemed fit for human consumption is like. So
yeah, I mean, they put
healthier without that.
They put dogs and cats pets that are killed at shelters oftentimes end up as part of
the surrendering problem. Fed to your dogs.
Yeah, they get fed to your dogs, which is, you know, raises a lot of issues, actually.
Yeah, no kidding. If only they could, you know, vocalize and tell us what they would like, too, right? Well, you sort of got to the heart of something that I wanted to talk about, too, is our ancestry and our heritage and where we've come from and how we've evolved. And, you know, there's this whole move to the what they call the paleo diet now. And you know, some argue that, well, you know, hunting was a big part of our tradition as human species. And so therefore, you know, it's okay to continue to do this humanely. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think this is, I think romanticism is the wrong word, but it's a strange sort of, it's a strange element that we drag into our modern thinking. I mean, this is a society that's waiting outside Apple stores to have our newest piece of technology, and we're worrying about what our hunter ancestors did. Most of us don't have much real understanding of what our hunter ancestors did, but we're really happy to hear, oh my goodness, they ate meat of and followed this diet. So I'm actually happy to characterize that sort of approach as silly. I think it's silly and self-serving. I'm always interested when people in my law school classes raise that, because I'm saying you're paying a large amount of money and spending 3 years of your life learning all the rules and regulations that we are applying to stop us doing what comes naturally. But suddenly, if you want meat on your plate, you have the appeal to this fictional, mythical, noble hunter who said prayers over the animal that he or she was going to eat. Most of my students are not running out into the streets of New Jersey to tackle a bison and take it home for food that night. So I'm quite happy to dismiss that as silly.
I think also, Janine, I mean, first of all, you say, you know, we were. So, I mean, it depends. You know, when you say we were, who are we referring to? I mean, there have been large chunks of humans throughout history who did not eat meat, certainly, but there have been a number of them that didn't eat any animal products, and they developed just fine. There is no evidence that people who historically consumed plant foods were developmentally disadvantaged in any way, and indeed there is historical dispute. As a matter of fact, I'm looking for a quote from Eat Like You Care, the book that Anna and I did, from an essay from a Scientific American, in which the author says, you know, there's this idea that, you know, that we were, you know, that we ate a lot of animal products, and in fact we didn't. And there's good evidence that we didn't. Eventually I will find that quote and I will interject it at a probably inappropriate point in the interview. But the issue is really, do we need to eat animals to be optimally healthy? And I want to read you a quote that I did find. This is from the extremely conservative Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, which used to be the American Dietetic Association, not a radical organization. This is a quote. It is the position of the American Dietetic Association that appropriately planned vegetarian diets, including total vegetarian or vegan diets, are healthful, nutritionally adequate, and may provide health benefits in the prevention and treatment of certain diseases. Well-planned vegetarian diets are appropriate for individuals during all stages of the life cycle, including pregnancy, lactation, infancy, childhood, adolescence, and for athletes. And that's a quote from the American Dietetic Association, which is now called the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. But, I mean, there's no reason that we have to eat this stuff. So when somebody says to me, well, you know, our ancestors did this, our ancestors, you know what? Our ancestors did lots of stuff, much of which was immoral. I mean, they engaged in all sorts of violent conduct. And if you want to talk about historically what we've done, there is, you know, next to speciesism and next to our treatment of non-human animals as human resources, I would say the runner up there for pervasive contender for discrimination is sexism. So I mean, you know, we've as a species, we have historically been virulently sexist. So what? It's wrong. The fact that we did it, and the fact that we did it a lot, and the fact that it's pervasive across cultures, who cares? It's wrong. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, whether it's in one culture or 6,000 cultures. It doesn't matter. It's wrong. Sexism is wrong. And so, you know, the idea that, you know, something is pervasive, so what? You know, lots of stuff is pervasive. Racism, like, is another pervasive thing. I would say it's, you know, it's not, it's really pervasive, but not quite as pervasive as sexism, which I think is so pervasive that we, you know, it's hard for us even to recognize it, because, you know, the world is patriarchal, and it's so patriarchal that you don't even realize it. Racism, you can identify more because it's got a, you know, it's got a trigger connected to the arbitrary and silly thing of skin color, but I mean, at least it's got some identifiable, arguably identifiable criterion. Whereas sexism is just so pervasive; it pervades everything about the society, how it's structured, our educational system, our, you know, everything is infected and affected by sexism. So what? That doesn't make it right. Hmm. As a matter of fact, that really sort of, you know, presents us with an even greater challenge, I think.
Well, that's another core issue that I'd like to speak about. For folks who are just tuning in, I just want to let them know that I'm speaking today with Gary Francione and his partner Anna Charlton. They're both professors at Rutgers University. And one of the things I wanted to talk about is this the idea of feminism and the idea of sympathy with the female of the animal species who really bear the burden in terms of, you know, producing the next generation of what some people call food, and you know, the connection between feminism, the feminist ideal of you know, that we respect each individual as an equal and respect their inherent rights. And I'm just curious how you feel. I've had someone mention to me that, you know, it's not about, you can't apply feminism to animals because it's a different species. Feminism only applies to the human species. But to me, I think if someone's going to call themselves a feminist and drink milk, for example, that's problematic. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I can't see any reason why the concerns that underlie feminism are not quite appropriately extended to the female non-humans who, as you said, bear the brunt of the exploitation and commodification. I mean, if we are opposed to the exploitation or the prejudice against female humans and the prejudice against them because of the impact of their reproductive processes or the commodification of their reproductive processes, that is so much underpinning the industry of meat and dairy production. Those animals are exploited in an extreme way because of their reproductive abilities. We continually, repeatedly destroy the relationship that they have with their offspring. And we reduce them to milk and child-bearing machines.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always say to people that I don't regard vegetarianism as a morally coherent position, because I do not see a morally coherent distinction between meat and other animal products, because the animals used for dairy and for eggs are, you know, treated every bit as badly. Many of them, the animals used in dairy, for example, are kept alive longer. They're treated every bit as badly, and they all end up in the same slaughterhouse anyway. And egg production is just hideous. And so, you know, and both dairy and eggs involve commodifying the female's reproductive process, and particularly in the case of dairy, interfering with her relationship with her baby, because in order for a cow to give milk, she's got to be pregnant. You know, she's a mammal. Like all other mammals, they don't just automatically give milk. They have to be pregnant. And so, you know, we keep them constantly pregnant. we take their babies away from them, you know, sometimes within hours, and if they're on an organic happy farm, maybe a couple days, maybe, and we take their male babies away, we sell them to the veal industry, we take their female babies away, and we cycle them through the dairy industry, and you know, and the idea that, you know, somebody says, well, I don't eat meat, but I consume dairy, the answer is that's like saying, well, I consume the meat from large cows, but I will not, consume the meat from medium-sized cows or something. I mean, it's an arbitrary line to draw because all animal products involve suffering. All animal products involve death. As a matter of fact, the number of deaths per 1,000 calories of eggs is higher than for anything else except for chickens. So if you're a meat eater, if you're eating a lot of beef and pork, and you say, well, I'm going to become a vegetarian, and you start, you know, and you start eating a lot of eggs because you think you need eggs for protein, which you don't, and you start eating a lot of eggs, you're actually responsible for more animal deaths than if you stayed eating beef or pork. Now, of course, I'm not recommending that you stay eating beef and pork. My view is that you shouldn't be eating any of it or drinking any of it or wearing any of it. But the idea that we draw this distinction between meat and other animal products is just absurd.
All right.
The female animals who have been genetically manipulated and structurally changed to produce more animal products. Chickens are bred and chosen for their ability to churn out eggs in the most economically beneficial way for their owners. You've seen the difference in the structure of a chicken with these unbalanced breasts and cows now produce several times more milk per day than they did even in the 1950s. The cows now basically are four legs standing around an enormous, grotesque udder. So if that's not the commodification of a female that should concern someone who's interested in feminism, then I think there's a lack of understanding of the principles that inform the feminism in the human context.
I mean, to say that we should only care about feminism where humans are concerned is like saying we should only care about feminism where white women are concerned or where, you know, I mean, these are arbitrary lines. There's nothing, what speciesism is devaluing another simply on the basis of species. And to say that a cow's relationship with her baby or her reproductive processes are any less valuable than than similar interests of human women is arbitrary. I mean, what's the argument for that? The argument is, well, because they're animals, and the answer is, well, that's like saying they're black and we're white, or they're female and we're male. I mean, these are arbitrary distinctions. Mm-hmm. And just as they can't be justified in the human context, they can't be justified in terms of how we relate to non-humans.
You're listening to Women on Air at CFUV Radio 101.9 FM in Victoria, and I will proceed with the second half of the discussion I had with Gary Francione and Anna Charlton, who are professors of law and animal rights law at Rutgers University.
Are you familiar with, there was an American football player named Michael Vick. Are you familiar with him?
No.
Okay. Michael Vick is a football player. He was arrested in 2007 because he was then playing for the Atlanta Falcons, and he was arrested because he had a dog fighting operation in some property he owned in Virginia. And I can tell you that the guy, he went to prison for a couple years. He came out, and he still can't show up anywhere without having people boycott. I mean, people hate Michael Vick because he engaged in dog fighting. And I find this as a sociological matter interesting on a number of different levels. One of which is he's a man of color, and I think that raises some issues. But putting that aside, the reason why people are upset with Michael Vick is because they think that what he did was wrong, because he imposed suffering and death on dogs, and he didn't have a good reason for doing so. Because we all agree it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering and death on animals. And we could have an interesting philosophical discussion about what necessity means, but if it has any meaning whatsoever, it means we can't impose suffering and death for the reasons of pleasure, amusement, or convenience. Because if you have a rule that says you shouldn't, impose unnecessary suffering, but necessity can be satisfied by the fact that you get pleasure or you get amusement out of imposing suffering or death, then you've got an exception that has just swallowed the rule. And so that's why people get upset with Michael Vick, because he imposed suffering and death, and it was completely unnecessary because his best justification was he enjoyed it. We are consuming 58 billion land animals a year. 58 billion. A billion is 1,000 million. And that's a huge, huge number. And with respect to aquatic animals, nobody even knows the number. I mean, a low conservative estimate is like a trillion, okay, which is a million million. So, and you know, and most of those animals are sentient. I mean, I don't know about mussels and clams. I don't eat them. I err in favor of their sentience. There are some gray areas, but, you know, I think what I've seen convinces me that they are probably sentient, so I don't eat them. But the fish are, the lobsters are, and certainly all of the chickens, pigs, cows, calves, goats, sheep, you know, all of those animals are sentient. They all have subjective awareness. They all have subject, you know, they all have perceptual awareness. They all have subjective awareness. And the idea that we are inflicting suffering, you know, we're no better than the guy who's engaging in dogfighting. He enjoys sitting around a pit watching dogs fight, or he did before they arrested him. But and the rest of us enjoy sitting around the summer barbecue pit roasting the corpses of animals and consuming animal products from animals that have been treated every bit as badly as the dogs used in dogfighting. And our best justification is we enjoy the taste because there is no necessity. We don't need to do it for health. And as far as the environment is concerned, animal agriculture is an ecological disaster. It's an ecological disaster. I mean, you know, the methane emissions from ruminating animals, it constitutes the largest single source of greenhouse gases, basically, more so than the burning of fossil fuels for transportation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, animal agriculture is an ecological disaster, and it's not necessary. So the best justification we have for imposing suffering and death on all of those animals is that they taste good. Now, we could, you know, again, we can spend a lot of time, and I'd be more than happy at some point, if you'd like, to have complicated discussions about rights theory. But you know what? You don't need rights theory to really understand that the idea that we ought to be vegans is something that we already believe morally. Everything we need to believe to get us to the conclusion that veganism is the only rational response. If you regard animals as having any moral value whatsoever, and you agree with the idea that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering on animals, and you understand that necessity cannot, as a matter of logical coherence, as a matter of coherence, be satisfied by pleasure or amusement, you've got to come to the conclusion, without any complicated rights theory or anything difficult or weird or extreme, that you're committed to veganism. You've got a lot of climate change deniers out there, and you know part of the problem is if your political ideology has a problem with climate change. You know, you can find people out there, like you can find people out there who can tell you, you know, who will tell you that, you know, you're going to drop dead if you don't eat lots of meat and dairy, when the empirical evidence is really quite to the contrary.
So we're at CFUV 101.9 FM. If people have just tuned in, I'm speaking with Gary Francione and Anna Charlton from the Rutgers University of Law at Newark. I'm curious a little bit about your students. You know, who's signing up for your courses, and what kind of reaction do you get from them?
Well, we get really a cross-section. Some people who have had, particularly Gary as a professor for other courses and just enjoy him as a teacher, think, oh, well, let's listen to him talk about this issue. Rutgers has a long tradition interest in human rights, so the question of animal rights seemed to be a good fit for the Rutgers curriculum. And we have well-attended, boisterous, energetic classes all the time. I think we had 90 students in our day class, and we also offer it for an evening class. We're always fully subscribed, and we have very interesting conversations. Not always agreement. We're not looking for that, but good thrashing out of ideas.
Yeah, what we do in the class is we focus on racism, sexism, heterosexism, classism to some degree, and speciesism. And we try to show how the process of otherization, as it were, that's what we call it, is similar. You know, in all of these forms of discrimination, there are similarities. You know, they're all different, but they're all the same, and in certain ways. And so what we try to do is show how, we use race and how we use sex and how we use social constructions of gender and sexual orientation or preference, and how all of these things sort of are used to marginalize certain people and to exclude them from full membership in the moral community. And then we about a third, maybe even closer to a half of the class, we talk about the animal question, because, you know, Rutgers has a very progressive student population, and so you're not going to get a whole lot of art. You'll get, you know, we will have some arguments, because some students will think that affirmative action is not a good idea, or is problematic in some ways, or, you know, when we did the stuff on sexism this year, we had some rather interesting classes because there were some people who really took issue with our view of the sort of Catherine McKinnon, Andrea Dworkin sort of form of feminism, which a lot of them are really sort of unfamiliar with. I mean, that's the sort of feminism that we grew up with, as it were, and that makes the most sense to us. But for a lot of the postmodern feminists, the whole radical feminist thing is if they know anything about it, they don't like it. And so I'm not saying all the young people, but some young people. And so we have these, you know, we have interesting discussions about things. But for the most part, there will be disagreements when we're talking about racism, sexism, heterosexism, and classism. But when we get to animals, then it's real. Then it's profound, because, you know, there'll be a couple of students in the class who already are, you know, are sort of, you know, share these views. They were philosophy majors undergraduate, or they, you know, and they came to, or they read some of my stuff before they got here, and, you know, they agree with the ideas. But for the most part, students don't, and so we get into very, very interesting discussions, because, you know, a lot of the students are, you know, what we eat is really important in terms of, you know, it has a lot of cultural significance, and we have a lot of diversity here at Rutgers, which is one of the reasons why it's a terrific place. And so for many of our students, much of their lives sort of focus around food ritual sorts of things. And so, you know, we have very interesting discussions, because, you know, you mentioned something about, you know, when you told us about the show and suggested some of the things you'd like to talk about, one of the things that you mentioned was, you know, the sorts of things that we hear, you know, as vegans. What sorts of things do you hear? And one of the things that you hear is, well, you know, are you saying that my grandmother is a bad person because, you know, I my fondest memories are, you know, going over on Sunday to, you know, eat it at my grandmother's house, and she always prepared some meat dish, and now you're saying my grandmother's an evil person. I'm saying, no, I'm not saying that at all. You know, but that's how, you know, I mean, that's one of the things that you hear a lot, and you know, there are some cultures where eating meat is really sort of connected with manhood and, you know, and gender issues and stuff. And so you've got to unpack all that stuff and sort of show them how this all works. And it's remarkable. We love teaching the class because, you know, we do get a good enrollment. I think actually we had 70 in the day class, and I think, I don't know, 15 in the evening class this year. So, which is a very, you know, a very high enrollment for a class like that. And it's, some of the discussions are just remarkable. And I think, and we have a lot, we always have a lot of students who come to us afterward and say, you know, I've never had a course like this before. I've never had people challenge these things before. I've never had people talk this way to me before. And I think that's important. I think it's important to sort of shake people up and provoke them, because that's how you learn. Is, you know, you don't, if you're in a comfort zone all the time, you don't learn anything. You need to be shaken up. You need to be provoked. You need to be challenged.
I'm imagining that one of the discussions that you have, there's some audio on your website, abolitionistapproach.com. There's a whole audio section that I would invite people to go to. One area that you like to talk about, it seems like, Gary, and I assume too, is the animal welfare versus abolition discussion. Do you want to touch on that?
Oh, my goodness, Gary, why don't you go first on that one?
Well, you know, we can talk about that for, say, 3 days, but I'll give you the three-hour version. No, animal welfare reform. Look, animals are property, Janine. They don't have any intrinsic or inherent value. They only have extrinsic or external value. It costs money to protect their interests. And as a general matter, we only protect their interests when we get a benefit, mostly economic, from doing so. Now, you know, many of us live with dogs and cats, and we don't think of them as property. But as far as the law is concerned, they are property. Whether it's the United States, Canada, or Cucamonga, it doesn't really matter. I mean, animals are property. And they, you know, if you want, you can value your dog in such a way that you spend a lot of money on veterinary care for your dog, and you buy your dog really good food, or you make your dog really good food, or you do all sorts of things for your dog, and you really value your dog very highly. You can also, because your dog is your property, value your dog very lowly. And as long as you provide the dog with minimal food, shelter, and food, water, and shelter, you can get away with that in just about every place on the planet. And so, if you want to, you know, if you want to keep your dog in your house and have your dog be a member of the family, that's great. If you want to keep your dog chained outside and use your dog as a guard dog, as long as you give the dog enough food and water and shelter, you can do that, and you can never show the dog any affection. And when the dog doesn't bark when a stranger gets to the house, you can go out and beat the dog, and basically no court's going to stop you from doing that. And so, you know, most of the time, the welfare reforms that we've seen, and this is something I spent a lot of time doing when I was younger, was looking at animal welfare reform. And what I concluded was, throughout the history of animal welfare reform, which basically started in the 19th century in Britain and spread very, very quickly all over the place, but basically, most animal welfare reforms were things that actually made animal use more economically efficient. Let me give you an example. The 1958 Humane Slaughter Act in the United States, which required that cows, pigs, sheep, you know, large animals be stunned before they're shackled, hoisted, and cut. Now, the reason why industry went along with that was because it was economically efficient. If you have a 2,000-pound animal hanging upside down by one leg and her pelvis breaks, she's moving around, she's in pain, she hits workers, that's a cost, and she incurs carcass damage, which is a real big cost when you're talking about a cow or a large animal like that, which reduces the value of her meat. And so the Humane Slaughter Act actually, you know, makes the whole process more economically efficient. And what's interesting is in 1958, when that was passed in the United States, it didn't apply to chickens because people thought, well, you know, chickens, I mean, you know, they weigh a couple pounds, you know, they're not going to have carcass damage, they're not going to cause worker injuries and things like that. Well, now you have groups, welfare groups like PETA and the Humane Society of the United States and Mercy for Animals, all these other organizations, and they promote welfare reform. And one of the campaigns that PETA's promoting, and indeed quite vociferous in Canada, is that chickens ought to be gassed instead of killed the way that they're presently killed, which involves shocking them and decapitating them and defeathering them and stuff. It's really quite horrible. But PETA is promoting the idea of gassing them. And if you read PETA's literature on that, they cite study after study after study after study, which shows that gassing chickens is a much more economically efficient way of killing them, which is why Kentucky Fried Chicken in Canada agreed to phase in getting their chicken from suppliers that gassed the chickens rather than used the decapitation, bleeding out, defeathering method. And the reason for that is simple, that it makes perfect sense to, you know, if you were going to start a chicken slaughterhouse tomorrow, you would be insane not to use controlled atmosphere killing. So what's happening is you've got a number of these companies, a number of these suppliers that have a lot of money invested in the present equipment, and they're phasing that out as they get their tax advantages, and their tax advantages are sort of spent out. What they'll do is they'll switch to controlled atmosphere killing or gassing the chickens because it's the economically efficient thing to do. And so one of the arguments arguments I always make to these welfare groups is, look, what you're arguing for is stuff that industry is going to do anyway because it's economically efficient. The problem is because we've got you people out there saying, putting your stamp of approval on what industry is going to do anyway because it's economically efficient. What you're doing is conveying to the public the idea that there's a compassionate way to exploit, and that's just wrong. And I've, you know, most of these organizations, Janine, most of them, you know, from PETA to the Humane Society to, you know, there are Canadian organizations that fit this mold. And I think that what animal rights people ought to be doing is promoting no consumption of animals. And period. End of story. Because if we had a movement that promoted the abolition of animal use, industry would respond with the same measures that they are now working with animal groups to implement, because those are the economically efficient things to do. They would do them anyway, and the difference would be is you wouldn't have the complicity, the stamp of approval. You wouldn't have Peter Singer sending a letter to Whole Foods, he signed on behalf of PETA, Mercy for Animals, Compassion Over Killing, Viva, and all these other organizations, expressing appreciation and support. That's a quote: appreciation and support to Whole Foods for their pioneering program of happy exploitation. And pioneering is a quote as well. So, you know, when the guy who is considered to be the father of the animal rights movement is busy saying that Whole Foods is doing a great job and we're expressing our appreciation and support to Whole Foods, what sort of moral message does that send to the public? And the moral message it sends to the public is that there's a compassionate way to exploit. If you want to eat meat, just go to Whole Foods and buy happy meat or happy eggs or happy milk. Nonsense.
Anna?
Well, exactly, and I think at the interface of the consumer with the producer there, we're being told by these welfare campaigns that you're buying a healthy dose of compassion at the same time that you're buying an animal product. And as Gary was mentioning, there is no feasible way to produce food from 56 or 58 billion animals who are killed, land animals, every year. And there's no way to do it at the price that we are demanding for our food. And there's just no way to do it nicely. So we are reassured. We have this concern that most of us have underlying our use of animals, because we do recognize that they are living beings and we're worried that they might have interests that are being harmed by our use and consumption of them. And the producers and the retailers are saying, don't worry, we can do it nicely. Buy this. It's okay. Mm. And we assuage our consciences that way. And unfortunately, because the animal movement is looking for discrete campaigns, everyone wants a campaign and a victory, psychologically, for fundraising reasons, for territory reasons, all these reasons really cause them to be looking for these, just a target. Let's worry about this today. We can sort this out for you. It becomes a scattered, incoherent approach to really addressing the real problems of animal use. And I think that's what the animal rights movement has degenerated into. Everyone's looking for a welfare campaign.
And you know, they, in a sense, they have a really great economic motive to do that, and that is they want their donor base to be as broad as possible. You know, this morning when I was coming in, I got an email. I was reading on the train, and from the Animal Legal Defense Fund, and they were saying, you know, that they've got a zero tolerance for animal cruelty, and they talk about some guy. It's ironic, actually. There was a guy who put tape around the muzzle of his dog and taped the legs together, the limbs together, and threw the dog into a chicken coop, presumably to die. And somebody found the dog, and the dog was saved. And this guy was fined $500 and spent 2 days in jail. And the Animal Legal Defense Fund says, "Well, this is really horrible. We've got to do something about this." They never mentioned the chickens, and it's and they never mentioned the fact that, you know, so they've got zero tolerance for cruelty. But what that does is it normalizes exploitation by basically saying what cruelty is what we do to dogs and cats.
Exactly. You can't put your dog in a chicken coop.
Right.
Surely put chickens in a
right. Exactly. You can't. Right. You put your dog in a chicken coop. You get fined $500 and you serve a couple days in jail. You put the chickens in a chicken coop, and that's fine. And so, you know, and now why is it that if they're going to have a campaign campaign like that, they don't explicitly link all these forms of exploitation together and say, you know, and try to use that as a teaching tool to say, you should care about the chickens as much as you care about the dogs. Why are some animals members of our family, and why do other animals we stick forks in? You know, why do we stick forks into other animals? It just doesn't make any sense.
All right, I'm going to leave it there. That was a rebroadcast of a show that I aired on The Winds of Change, which is airing from CFUV every other Thursday, 11 till noon. You are listening to CFUV Radio 101.9 FM or online at cfuv.uvic.ca. If you want to re-listen to this or hear the very end of it, or any of the other shows that I do are on my blog at janinebancroft.wordpress.com. So lots going on. Check our website, cfuv.uvic.ca. Thanks so much for listening.